The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We have a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we'll be interviewing former ambassador to Israel and Egypt, Daniel Kurtzer, who has written a book called The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace. And he will be actually speaking at the JCC in a couple of weeks. We have a wonderful assortment of music. We do have a Purim piece. This whole 2 months, I'm going to be playing, God willing, something Purim-ish, Purim-esque, or exactly Purim music, because we're in the 2 months of the month of Purim, and we talked about that last week. We have the portion of Ki Siso, which can be found in chapter 30 of the book of Exodus and following. We have the story for this week. Unbelievable. You want to stay all the way to the end to hear the Hasidic story? Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Captain Tal Nachman, who's 21 years old, was killed by friendly fire near the Gaza border. Nachman was on patrol near an Israeli intelligence unit when a Givati Brigade soldier thought he was a terrorist and shot him. We're sorry about that. Palestinians in Gaza fired 2 rockets into Israel. One of them landed in Ashkelon. The rockets were not intercepted by the Iron Dome, but exploded in open fields. No one was hurt. It's interesting that in the city of Ashkelon, which is pretty dense, they have open fields. Israeli border police arrested 3 people for trying to smuggle military assault pistols into Jenin. The smugglers were stopped at a routine checkpoint. A policewoman noticed the passenger's uneasiness and ordered an inspection of the vehicle. Israel offered $20 million in compensation to the families of Turkish citizens killed during the 2010 Mavi Marama flotilla, which tried to illegally break the IDF blockade in Gaza. 9 Turkish Islamists were killed as they violently attacked IDF soldiers who boarded their ship. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu formally apologized to Turkey last March for the soldiers' use of force for saving their own lives. Little tongue-in-cheek there, a little bit of, you know, skepticism. Anyway, communities in Judea and Samaria will be having infrastructure built for wind and solar energy. The hills of Judea are perfect for wind. And when you say the hills are alive, it'll be like, wow. And finally, Woodside Petroleum of Australia will pay Israel $2.5 billion for the right to export natural gas from the Leviathan gas fields off the coast of Haifa. Israel's parliament said that up to 40% of the gas gathered from that field can be exported. Production is set to be set by 2017. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Mr. Daniel Kurzer, who was a former ambassador to the country of Israel and Egypt for the United States of America, has written a book, The Peace Puzzle. We'll be speaking, coming up, we'll give you the details at the end of the interview, at the Jewish Center in West Bloomfield. How are you today, Mr. Kurzer?
I'm fine, thank you. It's good to join you.
The pleasure, and thank you so much. Tell us about being ambassador to Israel and Egypt and trying to deal with the puzzles or the pieces of the peace puzzle, if you could, before we start talking about your book.
Well, first of all, it was a great privilege to serve the United States in those capacities, to be named to Israel by President Clinton and to Egypt by President Clinton, to Israel by President Bush, was a confirmation of professional standing, and I really was honored. But it was also a tremendous challenge in both countries. The Egypt relationship is very complicated. We know today how difficult it's been since the revolution that started in 2011 for the society to get back on its feet. And many of those problems were evident to us even during the Mubarak years. And then in Israel, I arrived right after the second Palestinian Intifada had started and worked with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in very close coordination in trying to deal with the challenges to Israeli security and well-being. So, we achieved a few small steps towards the goal of peace, but in large part, in both cases, it was maintaining strong relationships between the United States and these two countries.
Mm, indeed. Tell us about the book, The Peace Puzzle. There's been tons of material written about the whole process and getting to it, and if there can be peace, and what is the peace, and who's peace, and how peace. What's the nuance of the peace puzzle that you've written?
Well, back about 6-7 years ago, I formed a working group out of the United States Institute of Peace, which is a U.S. government-funded think tank in Washington, to look at peace process issues, and brought together four of the finest, most balanced, most experienced academics and practitioners around. And as we looked into the academic and policy study of the peace process, what we concluded is that there was, in fact, a lot of material, but most of it was partisan. In other words, autobiographies or memoirs that told the story of the peace process from the perspective of the individual. But for the average reader, it would be hard then to form a judgment based on competing narratives. So what we tried to do, and it was an objective that was quite challenging, was to create some ground truth. In other words, what actually happened between the years 1989 and 2011, which is the time frame of our book, covers the Bush, Clinton, Bush, and part of the Obama administrations. What actually happened, the give and take, the ups and downs, the progress or lack of progress, so that there would be in one place, both for students of the conflict, but also for the general public, a narrative which we hope is fair and reasonable. And so we picked five or six of the most critical junctures, the movement from the Madrid Peace Conference to the Oslo Accord, the Israeli-Syrian engagement, Camp David, the Bush years, the first part of the Obama administration, and tried to explain in understandable language how this puzzle of making peace either unfolded positively or in many cases actually did not.
Okay, indeed. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Daniel Kurzer, former ambassador to Israel and Egypt from the United States, wrote a book, The Peace Puzzle. We'll be speaking at the JCC coming up. Let's talk a little philosophy. Let's back up a little bit. The United States has always been very super friendly to the United States, all the way going back to Truman, and every administration since has really shown its friendliness to Israel, and it was augmented. It was hiked up, ratcheted up a whole many notches during the Nixon administration, with the making of peace and trying to exert peace between Egypt and Israel there. And then every ensuing administration afterwards. Why? But what I really want to know is, there's this conflict going on in this piece of territory located on the Mediterranean. Why is it that the American administrations feel they have to be the peacemakers?
Well, I think it's a marriage rather than a unilateral decision. What I mean by that is, since the early 1970s, really with the onset of Henry Kissinger's tenure, and proceeding almost uninterrupted, it's not just been a U.S. interest to be a part of the peace process, but Israel and the Arab side, whether it's Palestinians or Arab states, have wanted the United States engaged. And that's for a lot of reasons. For Israel, the United States, being its best friend, its strategic ally, can provide a great deal of confidence on critical issues that may allow Israel to decide to take risks for peace. And anything Israel does is going to be risky. And therefore, looking for an ally or a safety net is quite important for Israel. For the Arabs, it's almost the flip side of that issue. They know the relationship we have with Israel. They're jealous of it in some respects, but they also understand that it's only the United States that might be able to help Israel make those tough decisions. So you have this combination of American self-interest, but the interest of the parties themselves that keeps us engaged more or less actively throughout this period.
Okay, understood. There's been a lot of effort made by the Israelis. We've had various consuls and ambassadors on this show over the past, we're on for 18 years now coming up, and over the course of the years have gone through many regimes, both Israeli and American. It seems a little bit more one-sided on the part of the Israelis, the overtures towards peace, than it does on the side of the Palestinians. And very often what can construed as bullying even on the part of the United States by the Israelis can perceive this as bullies. I know Menachem Begin, after the whole Camp David thing, actually became very depressed and wrote that he felt he had actually made a tremendous mistake and was pressured into it. Would you like to comment about that, please, Daniel Kurzer?
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with the perception. In fact, you know, Israel, in a sense, holds so many of the cards that there will be a sense of Palestinians and Arabs demanding things from Israel. They want territory. Israel's holding that territory. They want political independence, and Israel is now occupying the political space in which they want to exercise their own self-determination. So there's been a basic asymmetry in this conflict going back many years, and various prime ministers of Israel have understood this. Rabin understood it, Barak, Olmert, for sure. Sharon, even to a certain extent, understood it. And now the question is going to be whether Netanyahu also sees things the same way. Now, that doesn't mean that Israel necessarily has to bend over to a point of yielding to all the demands of the other side. Israel has critical requirements relating to security. It has political interests in much of the territory that's under dispute. It has major concerns about the future of Jerusalem. And it has a very firm position on the question of the non-return to Palestine of the refugees. So it's not that Israel is expected to give up all of its positions, but they are in a very strong position relative to the adversaries with whom they're negotiating. And therefore, it's going to be a situation in which there is an imbalance in the kinds of demands that both sides make. I would also push back on the idea that the U.S. has somehow not been fair. You've had difficulties every time we've had a peace process. There was a crisis back in the Ford administration when Kissinger was negotiating a disengagement agreement between Israel and Egypt. Jimmy Carter had problems between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. James Baker had problems with Yitzhak Shamir and Hafez al-Assad. And therefore, it's not unusual that the Secretary of State, in this case John Kerry, as you approach decision time, is going to run into very strong feelings on both sides, both claiming that he's being unfair. But in fact, the United States, I think, has been pretty much the definition of an honest broker here.
Okay, hopefully. Talk about honest brokers and honest parties. The Palestinians maintain that if you would give us our land and allow us to establish our own state, then there would be peace. Yet there was a pullout from Gaza. There was only 7,500 settlers who were living in Gaza, and Israel determined that it would be more cost-effective to get them out of there than rather than trying to protect them and putting up all kinds of defense funds for them. So they pulled them out. And then what happens? I don't know if you heard my news as I was telling it over. Usually what I say is, this week's rockets from Gaza. You know, so it's like, it's not even, it's to the point where I don't even want to talk about it anymore because it's not news anymore. It's like, of course, there are rockets that are going to be coming from Gaza. So the Palestinians have shown who they are up till now, that if we give you a little bit, well, we're going to want a little bit more. And I'm actually right now looking at the Palestinian Authority website, and the homepage has a map of Palestine on it, and it includes the entire country of Israel. So they're showing who they are and what kind of peace they really want. How is it that Israel should be expected to make peace with such a partner, and how is it the Americans can insist on making peace with such a partner? Daniel Kurzer.
You know, one of the things that we were able to illustrate in the book, The Peace Puzzle, was the distinction between the outcomes that were arranged through agreement and the outcomes that were arranged through unilateral activity. There have been four historical Israeli withdrawals from Arab territory, two of them as a result of agreements, the treaty with Egypt and the treaty with Jordan. In both of those cases, the treaties have been fulfilled most meticulously in their security aspects. I know Israel's not very happy with some of the normalization results of those treaties.
Sure, we have, for example, tunnels that are going from the Sinai into Gaza, which are used for smuggling all kinds of weapons, which are being used.
Well, you had tunnels. Yeah, you had tunnels when Israel was occupying Gaza as well, and both sides have been faced with this problem. And many of the tunnels now going into Sinai are being used against the Egyptian government. You have right now an unprecedented degree of cooperation between Egypt and Israel on security. The point is that in the two withdrawals that resulted from agreement, where you had a partner on the Arab side and a responsible party and an address where you could there could be recourse for problems, those agreements work. In the two cases where you've had unilateral withdrawals, in Lebanon in 2000 and then Gaza 2005, they haven't worked because there's no partner, there's no address. I, in fact, argued at the time, I was ambassador at the time of the Gaza withdrawal, and I argued with Washington, saying, be ready for very strong Israeli responses to any violence that emanates from Gaza, because there will be no excuse for that violence. And we should support Israel if it responds even, quote-unquote, disproportionately to violence.
Bravo.
Israel decided at the time not to respond disproportionately, and you had a gradual buildup of rocket fire. But the basic point here is there going to be a withdrawal from territories based on an agreement, or is it going to be unilateral? I would argue very strongly against any further unilateral withdrawals, but I would also say that it's worth the risks to form an agreement in which you have a responsible party on the other side that says that it will actually carry out what it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. I recall, I'm not exactly sure after which agreement was, whether it was the Y Accords or the Madrid Accords or Oslo, one of them, I recall Yasser Arafat making a statement that if he goes back to his people and tells them that this is what he agreed to, he's going to get a bullet in his head. And that was sort of set the tone, I think, maybe for Mahmoud Abbas, that his hands are tied. He can't come back unless he gets everything that's on the table that they want. What do you think?
Well, you're recalling a statement attributed to Arafat from Camp David where there was no agreement. And Arafat was asked to accept positions that he didn't accept. So his argument in not accepting those positions, he told President Clinton at the time, I can't go back to my people with these positions. You haven't had a case yet of a Palestinian-Israeli agreement by which to measure real performance. You know, you cited in the earlier question the Palestinian textbooks that show a map of all the territory and calling it Palestine. Now, there was a study done recently by a nonpartisan group in the United States, and the argument there was, if you look at many Israeli textbooks, they also show no place called Palestine. It's all considered Israel, Judea, Samaria, and so forth. In other words, both sides tend to ascribe their maximalist positions in their own literature. Doesn't make it right. We have argued for a long time as a country against what we call incitement in Palestinian press and in their textbooks. But frankly, it's a problem that exists across the lines in conflict situations. It's not unusual.
Okay. Again, if you're just tuning in, our guest today is Daniel C. Kurtzer, who is a former ambassador from the United States through the countries of Israel and Egypt at different times. He didn't do it simultaneously. That would be really probably beyond human capabilities to do them both. Has written a book, The Peace Puzzle, and will be coming to Michigan, to Detroit, to speak at the Berman Center in a couple of weeks. Mr. Kurtzer, we've had Raymond Tanter on our show. Are you familiar with Mr. Tanter?
Sure.
Okay. He the last time I had him on, he made a very interesting statement. He said it's not actually important that there be peace in the Middle East, because his position is that there never will be peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. What's important is that there be a peace process so that the American government can be placated, that their involvement is not wasted, and that way the administration can go back to the Congress and say, well, let's keep funding this process and let's just keep things going as status quo. Is there any way that you envision that the status quo is going to be overcome?
I would respectfully disagree with Professor Tanter, whom I respect a great deal. I've read much of what he's written. You know, it may be inconvenient for those of us living in Princeton, New Jersey, or in Detroit, Michigan, to think about a peace process in which there's going to be difficult decisions. But it's very challenging for those on the ground. You know, you have Israeli friends. I have Israeli friends.
I have relatives.
So do I. We all have deep connections to both Israel and to the people of Israel. And to contemplate a situation in which there is a perpetual, chronic, protracted conflict is not healthy. It's not healthy for the society generally or for the people we love who live there. So the peace process should not be seen as some kind of a bicycle ride where the object is just keep pedaling. There's got to be a goal here, and that goal has to be a fair outcome in which both sides can achieve at least their minimal security, political, ideological, religious requirements. And I think that's still possible. It may not be easy to do, and there may be great decisions that have to be taken by great leaders. But I really would not want to see Israel fated to the idea that it's never going to have peace with its immediate neighbors. I think that would be a terrible outcome to plan for.
Yeah, it seems that we put a lot of emphasis over here. I had a daughter who spent the last 4 years living in Herzliya. Herzliya is an upscale neighborhood suburb of Tel Aviv. It would be for people living in Detroit, it would be sort of like the Bloomfield Hills area, like Westchester County, that type of an area of Israel. And she said that living in this area and attending school, she never knew anything about Palestine, and that people in the man in the street in Tel Aviv is more worried about his cell phone function than what a Palestinian conflict, because right now they're not being affected by it. So if the man in the street in Israel doesn't care, why should the person in Princeton or Detroit worry about it? Daniel Kurtzer?
It's a fair question. You know, the American embassy is in Tel Aviv, and we lived in what many Israelis call the Republic of Tel Aviv, because there is a sense, if you're looking west over the Mediterranean, that everything is just fine. The problem is that, you know, 50 miles up the road, there is a conflict, and it's a very deep, divisive conflict, which periodically flares up into terrible violence. And I, you know, I, for one, I have a sister living in Israel. I have two nieces and a nephew living in Israel. We lived in Israel for 8 years. Each of my three sons went to school in Israel. We have very deep connections to this place, in addition to my professional experience. As I mentioned, I don't want to see that country fated to the idea that it can live in some kind of a bubble when it can't, when you have a conflict of an intifada, a third intifada, God forbid, which is not going to be the same as the second. It's going to be worse because you have rockets. Or a third Lebanon war in which the Hezbollah has how many rockets now? 150,000, they say? You know, why would we want to plan for that in having a peace process when our goal should be a peace outcome?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. A rhetorical question there. Okay, let's talk a little current events. Things that are going on now, the shuttling back and forth of Secretary Kerry. We reported on the show 3 weeks ago a statement by Israel's Defense Secretary Yalon that basically said there's nobody talking to the Palestinians. The only peace process that's going on is between Israel and the United States, and that Mr. Kerry should hurry up and get his, quote, Nobel Prize and leave us alone. At which point, the Department of State issued a harsh statement, at which point Mr. Yalon apologized. And as my daughter, who spent time in Israel, one of my other daughters, said, oh, it was a typical Israeli apology. I'm sorry I hurt your feelings and you're a wussy man, which is basically what the apology was, not in that term. And then Kerry now presenting what has appeared as a threat of sanctions against Israel, even though in the statement it came out, there's a possibility that if you don't do this, we can boycott you, and then double tracking, saying, I didn't say the word boycott. I didn't mean the word boycott. We're not talking sanctions. So there seems to be a little bit of like rough edges now going on between the Israelis and the American Department of State. Could you comment on that, please, Daniel Kurtzer?
Look, I think Israeli rhetoric has been beyond the pale, and Yalon's comments were unacceptable. You wouldn't hear, under any circumstances, the same type of ad hominem attacks by a senior American official against an Israeli official. It just wouldn't happen, and therefore it shouldn't happen in Israel. Of all people today, in the Israeli press, the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, is quoted as saying Israelis ought to be nicer and more polite with respect to John Kerry, whom he respects a lot. And this is from a man who represents a right-wing party. So there's no question that Israeli rhetoric has gone a little bit too far, and hopefully Yalon's comments would be the last we hear in that regard. What Kerry has said, and I'm not a spokesman for the administration, but what Kerry has said was not a threat of a boycott. It was a threat in a sense of what others may do. What Kerry was saying to the Israeli people is, I'm your friend, and I'm telling you what I'm hearing from other countries is that if peace doesn't happen, you, Israel, may face boycotts from a lot of other folks. Now, some Israelis took that as a threat, as though he were somehow associating himself with it, but of course he's not. I mean, for 35 years, this man fought against that kind of nonsense when he was a senator. He's not going to switch now that he's Secretary of State. So, you know, should he have chosen different language? Was it appropriate to tell the Israelis that they may face boycotts? I don't know. I mean, this is up to the Secretary to decide, but it was certainly not a threat on his part. The United States is never going to boycott Israel and is not going to threaten Israel. It's going to put various choices before an Israeli government, and then the Israeli government has the right to choose which way it wants to go in issues that relate to its national security and well-being.
Okay. Now, you've written the book, The Peace Puzzle. It's, first of all, it's published by your organization, the United States Institute of Peace, together with Cornell University Press. Did you have anything to do with the cover design?
We have to approve it.
Okay, fine. So the cover design, it's a jigsaw puzzle, and there are two pieces of the puzzle which haven't been placed in the puzzle, and if you look very carefully, those two pieces don't fit. And then there's probably one, two, three, four or five pieces missing. So maybe I'm reading too deeply into the cover, but it seems like you have pieces of the puzzle that aren't fitting, and then you have missing pieces to the puzzle. So could you explain to us what the missing pieces of the puzzle are, of the Israeli peace accords might be, Daniel Kurtzer?
This is a wonderful question, because I have never actually looked at the cover in those terms. I think you're reading much too much into this cover.
I got a Gemara cup. What could I tell you?
I recognize that. I'm just surprised at myself for never having asked the same question. I don't think there was any hidden meaning here. There's no Rashi or Tosafot that we have to look at to try to figure out what it means. The idea was that there's an unfinished puzzle. Obviously, if you want to read into it, there are pieces that are not included on the cover but are probably sitting and waiting to be added to it. But I really think you may be reading a touch too much into the cover.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, again, our guest has, we want to thank you very much. We're running out of time. Our guest has been former ambassador of the United States to Israel and Egypt, Daniel Kurtzer, has written a book called The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, 1989 to 2011. It's published by Cornell Press, available wherever one acquires books at this point. And Mr. Kurtzer will be speaking on the topic of The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab Peace, at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, February the 25th. That's in about a week and a half or so, at the Berman Center for the Performing Arts, which is in the JCC building. Mr. Kurtzer, thank you so much for coming on and enlightening us and sharing your insights into this matter.
My pleasure.
Take care, and we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Joel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. We got some new music for you. This is Sholly Waldman, who is new on the music scene. And this is a piece called Siman Tov, which means should be a good sign. And Siman Tov and Mazel Tov, it should be like good sign, good luck, congratulations. So congratulations for tuning in. Let's listen in.
See me, come on, come on.
Of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Hey, Shul Finman. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. I hope you like that. It's time for our Purim part of our show. And this is called Haman HaRasha. Haman was the evil dude in the book of Esther. And he's referred to as Haman the Rasha, Haman the evil dude. And they have a whole song here. This is called the Hakatanim is the name of the group, which means the kids. And the main chorus of the song is actually a verse from the book of Esther, which is translated as, to the Jews, there was light and joy, gladness and song. So let's listen into Hakatan.
את כל היהודים
להשמיד, להרוג ולאבד את כל היהודים.
ליהודים הייתה...
art studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the art studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The art studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The art studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Schultzman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We're having more fun than any individual's allowed to have, so we'll do it as a group. I'm including you also. Up next is not an upbeat song, but it's a great song. I really like this song. It's called Shluff Mein Yankele. It's an old Yiddish lullaby, and the person whose rendition this is Mordechai Gebirtik, who I'm not exactly sure familiar with the artist, but he's got a really, if it's a lullaby, you would like this guy to sing you a lullaby. Let's listen in.
Lov se mir schon Yankele mein Scheiner Die Egelach, die Schwarzen kämacht zu A Yingele, was hat schon alle Zeindele Muss noch die Mame singen ein Lulu A Yingele, was hat schon alle Zeindele Muss noch die Mame singen, ein Lulu. Ein Ingele, was hat schon ein alle Zeindala und wird mit Masel bald in Cheder gehen und lernen wird er Chumisch und Gemore. Soll weinen, wenn die Mame wiegt ihm ein und lernen Der Chumisch und Gemore soll weinen, wenn die Mame wiegt ihm ein. Ein Ingele, was lernen wird Gemore, und steht der Tate, quält und hört sich zu. Ein Ingele, was wächst der Tal mit Hochem. Los ganze Nacht der Mame nicht zu ruh. Ein Ingele, was wächst der Tal mit Hochem. Los ganze Nacht der Mame nicht zu ruh. Ein Ingele, was wächst der Tal mit Hochem. Und nagenit er solcher euch zugleich. Ayingele hakluger chosn bocher Soll liegen also in Asle in a Teich Ayingele hakluger chosn bocher Soll liegen also in Asle in a Teich Derweil ich so in Wiegele bei mir. Es wird kosten noch viel mir und Mames Tränen. Bis wann ins Wetter Mensch alles von dir. Es wird kosten noch viel mir und Mames Tränen. Bis wann ins Wetter Mensch alles von dir. Thank you.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. The Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Kisisa, can be found in Exodus chapter 30 and following. The primary focus of the portion is the golden calf and its aftermath. We're not going to talk about that. So that's why I suggest you read it on your own. It's the last biblical story that we have until we get to the book of Numbers, and we won't do that until May. So tune in. Check it out yourself. I always encourage people to read the Bible every week. At the beginning of the portion, there's two other things that are sort of like stuck on. And we can talk about why they're there, but we're not going to. One of the things that's discussed is the copper wash basin, which the priests, the Kohanim, used to wash their hands and feet, remembering that they worked barefoot. They washed their hands and feet before they could go into the temple to do any services. They put water into this big, it looked like a huge samovar type thing. It had spigots in the desert. It had 2 spigots because they only had 3 priests in the desert. But by the time he came to the temple, there were thousands of priests. So they had 13 spigots, cut down on the wash time. The wash basin that was made in the desert was made out of a very specific copper gift. That was there was lots of copper given. The copper was used for the foundation of the sanctuary walls, the outer walls. This copper was donated by the women specifically. They had these copper mirrors that they would use. And what would they do with these mirrors? Is they would make themselves up and make themselves look really beautiful so that their husbands would come home after a full day of brick making and really just want to eat and go to sleep. But because these women were all, the Yiddish word is all verputzt. You know what that word means, Ben? Verputzt? You could imagine. It's onomatopoetic. It's like, you know, verputzt like means... The word puts means to polish.
Messed up. No.
Exactly opposite. It means over-polished. Okay? These ladies were like way up there. Okay? So their husbands would come home and they would take a look at their good-looking wives and then think about other things besides eating and going to sleep. And it says Moses didn't want to accept these mirrors because in his mind there was some sort of like vanity involved with it. Not immorality, because it's not immoral for a person to have relations with their wives, but vanity. And he thought that it would be best if these were not. Moses said, I don't want to take them. The women got all upset. The last thing you want to do is get a whole bunch of ladies upset about you, except like coming in mass. God said, take them because they are more precious to me than anything else. And indeed, everything else in the temple was dull. It was a matte finish. This was a highly polished finish. What's the deal? There are different ways of holiness. There's different patterns to holiness. There's one thing. You could have, for example, a holy item like a Torah scroll or a mezuzah or tefillin or something like that, or engage in some sort of a mitzvah, commandment, which that is sort of like a crystal clear way of achieving holiness. Then there's an obscured way of achieving holiness. Like, for example, breakfast. Breakfast should not be eaten just to satiate one's animal
desires of needing nourishment, but breakfast should be eaten because it's going to give the person the strength to go do the good things that need to be done during the day. If that be the case, then the act of eating breakfast now takes on holiness. So Moses thought that since this is supposed to be the sanctuary, the point of communion between God and the world, that it should be totally and completely transparent godliness. God came and said, no, this is more precious than me. That if we can take something that's really mundane and turn it into something holy, that's a higher thing. That's a lot better. And that's what we have to do to bring God into our lives. We have to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? www.rabbifinman.com. RABBIFINMAN. Like I tell people, yes, there are two N's in Finman, but in different places. RabbiFinman.com. Right on the homepage. Contact me. I contact you. Everybody's good. There's also archived editions of the show there for the last month or so. There's the U-Parsha, the E-Parsha, and the Hasidic U-Story, which are other media in which I present information about Judaism, hopefully in an entertaining and informational way. And the very, 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 at this point, important donations page. March is our 18th year anniversary. We have hopefully lots of big things planned, but it's February 9th, and we're still trying to collect funds to pay for January. The people here at WLQV 1500 AM on your AM dial in Detroit, they're very, very patient, and they're very good-hearted people. They're a wonderful, wonderful bunch of people. I'm still here, but I can't push it too much. We need your donations. It's tax-deductible. It is a charitable donation in the eyes of the Almighty. It'll come off if you can consider it part of your tithing, which I recommend, which is recommended by the Bible that you do. And anybody who gives to a charitable organization, so God says, listen, I'll take care of you. So you want God to take care of you? I suggest going right now to the computer and donating the amount of your choice, no amount too big or small, www.rabbifinman.com. Don't trust the computer. I understand. Send your donation any amount to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Very quick story. The Baal Shem Tov was asked by his students to have a vision of Elijah the prophet. One of the things since Elijah went to heaven alive. So he comes back and he visits people all the time. So they wanted to meet him. So he said, fine, come. Let's go to a certain place. They went to a certain, they got into the carriage, they got to a, came to a field, and the Baal Shem Tov suddenly said, I would like to smoke a pipe. This is well before the Surgeon General's warning, considering this is the 1700s. And has anybody got one? Nobody had a pipe. So he said, could you look around? Maybe somebody in the neighborhood has a pipe? They said, there's nobody around has a pipe. So the Baal Shem Tov said, there's a nobleman over there who's passing by. Maybe he has a pipe. So they went and they asked him. The nobleman came over himself, and he put some tobacco in the pipe. I guess it's like a real, you know, this is like a real thing to do is let people use your pipe. So he put it in and was smoking. And he said, he asked him, how's your crops these days? He said, how's the seeding going? He said, how's the harvest? They didn't pay attention to it too much. Then he left. And then the Baal Shem Tov said, well, I fulfilled my obligation. I showed you Elijah the prophet. He said, who? He said,
that nobleman was posing as Elijah the prophet. And he said, why didn't you tell us? And he said, well, you never asked me who he was, so I wasn't going to tell you. But when I asked him about the seating, I wanted to know, are we doing enough? And then, is the Almighty's response enough? That's it for the show. We want to thank you so much for tuning in. I hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care. Get up, get up, get up, get up, get up.